You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 23rd of May 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS.
It's 1600 in Canberra, 9 a.m. in Kyiv, 7 a.m. here in London and 2 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle 24. The Globalist starts now. Hello, this is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll begin in Ukraine, where a blockage of the ports is triggering a global food crisis. Then...
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change. Earlier tonight, Scott Morrison called me to congratulate myself and the Labor Party on our victory at the election.
All change in Australia. Anthony Albanese is the new Prime Minister. We'll have the latest results and analysis from Canberra. Then to Sri Lanka, where the economic and political crisis continues. We'll check in with our man in Davos, flick through the papers and the business news, plus...
I believe in magic, and I think as soon as you touch just the corner of magic, it disappears, and then you have to carry on chasing it. And so there's a kind of a constant... process in making art about that.
We'll hear from the renowned South African artist Beezy Bailey. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Ukraine and Poland have agreed on joint customs control to ease the movement of people and increase Ukraine's export potential. US President Joe Biden has assured Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida that the United States is fully committed to Japan's defence. And although votes in Australia are still being counted, Anthony Albanese was sworn in earlier today in order to attend a key meeting of the Quad Security Grouping in Tokyo tomorrow. We'll have more on that story a little bit later. And do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day. But first, the UN World Food Programme has warned of a global food crisis, and this is blamed to a large degree on the conflict in Ukraine. Before Russia invaded the country, over 90% of Ukraine's grain and oilseed exports, that's about 6 million tonnes per month, left by ship. Roughly 20 million tonnes of grain are stuck inside Ukraine, and the country's running out of storage capacity. Well, let's head straight there, where we can hear from Yulia Marashevska. She's a Ukrainian anti-corruption activist and a former civil servant. She's worked on customs reform and with the South Sea ports as chief of Odessa Customs. Yulia, has Russia been more successful on sea than on land?
Unfortunately, yes. Russia has completely blocked Ukrainian seaports in two seas, in Azov Sea and Black Sea. And that actually cut 75% of Ukrainian export. And that's, as you know, Ukraine is one of the biggest world exporter of grain, wheat, sunflower oil. Actually, the biggest in terms of sunflower oil. Russia blocked this export almost completely through the seaports.
And is there a way of circumnavigating Russian warships or having some kind of protective force to get the goods safely out?
We have a very hard discussions on this topic currently. And the problem is that even if we are... sending some kind of support with the Ukrainian ships, the air is still open. We don't have air defense still. We don't have enough fighter jets to close the sky even under these sea corridors. So but even to defend the ships from the shore, we would need a special shore-based anti-ship missiles to protect Ukrainian and other ships that will be coming to Ukrainian seaports. So unfortunately, at this moment, we don't have enough weaponry to protect Ukrainian Sea, Black Sea, in a military way.
So what are the alternative routes out of the country?
So currently 30% of the grain export is going through the river ports, through the Dunabi River. Ukraine is connected with Romania, and we are using three river ports to export like a small part of the grain and oil. But unfortunately, it's not enough. The railway is also working, and the automobile connection, like cars, tracks, we are using on the western border with Europe. But of course, the scale, the amount of the grain that you can export using railway and tracks, it's just it's impossible to compare. Like, imagine that 75% of Ukrainian export were exported with ships, with the sea.
I mean, this must represent a huge loss of income for Ukraine, even as it drives up food prices elsewhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's I think that it's one of the goals for Russia. They cannot win Ukraine in a military way. They want to destroy our economy.
Are crops still being harvested? Does Ukraine have enough storage capacity?
No, absolutely not. And this is the problem, because if this year the catastrophe isn't as big, the next year it will be huge if the seaports are not going to be open, because the Ukrainian storages are full and there is no place to put the harvest. So we can just lose it, even though we have quite a good weather conditions and the agriculture processes are going quite well in the territories which are not occupied, but the prospects aren't good in terms of having enough space in the storages.
And do Ukrainians have enough to eat, and have prices risen there too?
So the food security in Ukraine is really good. You know, we were a food security guarantee for a lot of countries all over the world, and all of this grain, all this crop which are stocked in the storages in Ukraine, it's much more than Ukraine needs. Because, you know, we were harvesting all these crops to bring it all over the world, to all the countries, to all other countries that don't have this kind of soils and don't have this opportunity to grow the crops. So we, in terms of food, we are good.
And can you bring us up to speed on what else has happened in the country over the weekend?
Every day we are getting news about these strikes. The situation on the east is quite bad. Mariupol is still occupied, so the condition of the occupied territories are horrible in terms of the access to clear water, the diseases. So the situation, we are still in an active stage of war. We are getting all this news about the rapes, the tortures that have happened during the Russian occupation of the parts of Ukraine. So the news we are getting aren't very good this weekend.
Yulia, thank you very much indeed. That's Yulia Marashevska there. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
We're off. off to Canberra next. In Australia, the centre-left Labour Party has retaken power after 9 years in opposition. Labour Party leader Anthony Albanese has been sworn in as the country's 31st Prime Minister, promising a journey of change as he vowed to tackle climate change, rising living costs and inequality. Well, Karen Middleton is the Saturday Paper's chief political correspondent in Canberra, and she joins me now. Karen, are the final votes counted yet?
No, I'm afraid they're not, Georgina. So we're still waiting for the outcome in a number of seats. It's not clear yet whether Labor will govern in a majority or whether it will have to rely on support from a bunch of independents and small parties to govern. But it's clear that it is the government. And as you say, Anthony Albanese has now been sworn in. He's sworn in, he's had four other members of his ministry sworn in as well. And the reason this has happened so quickly is that he and his new foreign minister, Penny Wong, have jetted off straight away to Japan to be a part of the quadrilateral security meeting with Japan, the United States and India. That meeting's on Wednesday, so there was no mucking around. They got straight into it. And the other three ministers he has sworn in are economic ministers, his deputy prime minister and employment minister, Richard Marles, his treasurer, Jim Chalmers, and his finance minister, who will also be the attorney general and minister for women, Katie Gallagher.
Now, voting is mandatory in Australia. Did most of the, I think it's 16 million eligible to vote, exercise their constitutional duty?
Yeah, voting is mandatory. Voting is compulsory in Australia. People are fined if they don't vote. And we usually get a very high turnout. I don't know what the turnout is yet because the votes haven't all been counted, but I would expect it would be an extremely high turnout. It was a very unusual election in the way people voted, because we're going to end up with so many independents on a crossbench in the lower house, the house where government is formed. It's common that Australians would vote primarily for major parties in the House of Representatives and then might vote differently in the Senate to sort of keep a check and balance on the government in the House. But this time they have in significant numbers voted for independence, which is being seen for in a number of ways, a big message of disillusionment to the big parties, but also a bit of a message about community empowerment. Don't take your community for granted. There was a message quite clearly there on the environment, because a number of these candidates were very environmentally focused and wanting action on climate change. And they were also demanding better treatment of women. And most of these candidates were women. And they want a federal integrity commission, an anti-corruption commission, which the Labor government has committed to. And the Liberal National Coalition Conservative government had only offered a sort of a weaker version of that. So there are a number of very strong themes and messages making this quite an unusual election.
And do you think then it's the end of the two-party system in Australia?
Not officially. I mean, it's sort of, we call it the two-party system, but in fact the Liberal government only ever governs in coalition with the Nationals, who are also a Conservative party. It's always confusing that we call the Conservatives the Liberals here. They govern with the Nationals, who are a rurally based Conservative party. But I think we will still see the on balance a two-party system for the time being. But there's definitely a message here, you know, with this very high independent vote, that people are sick and tired of the same old politicking and of governments ignoring community desires. I think the COVID pandemic of the last 2.5 years has really kind of galvanised people's sentiments about that, the ideas about border closures and lockdowns and some of the restrictions have caused some people to push back against government. But I think in general there's a sense that a loss of trust in public authorities and particularly government, and I think we're seeing some of that play out here too.
Now, of course, as you say, the independents did extremely well, the so-called teal wave, but how independent are they?
Well, that's a good question. So a number of them took funding support from an organisation called Climate 200, which was funded by businessman Simon Holmes Accord. So in that sense, there was a degree of coordination. And the ones we refer to as teal, who all campaigned in teal-coloured T-shirts, many of them were quite closely tied to that organisation. Now, the reason they're called teal is because they campaigned in seats that were traditionally Liberal-Conservative seats, and the Liberal Party's colour of choice is blue, but these candidates were very green in their outlook and their sentiment in terms of environmental issues, so hence the teal. How coordinated will they be in Parliament? Well, it's an excellent question. We've had some crossbenchers, some independents in the parliament already, who, while they are genuinely independent of each other, they do work together on issues where there's common ground. So I would expect that will happen again. And because a number of these women mostly have got their funding source and their general themes in common, you could expect that they'd work together quite a bit, almost as a significant third or fourth force. Interestingly, the Greens have also done very well in this election, particularly in Queensland, where they look like taking one, maybe two or more other lower house seats. So we're really seeing a big theme of environmentalism here, and I think those two forces, the new independents and the Greens, will put a lot of pressure on the incoming government on those kinds of issues.
And tell us more about Anthony Albanese. What are his main goals?
Well, I guess, I mean, I wrote his biography 6 years ago, so I'm quite familiar with him as a person and a politician. He's talking a lot about inclusiveness and diversity and ensuring that people are respected. He's been quite critical of the government as the previous government, as a divisive government, as a government that chose to sort of divide and split people. And he says he wants to listen and to consult, and he's doing a bit of that already this morning. He's been on the phone to those independent MPs who have already been in the parliament and have been re-elected, and he's obtained an assurance from them that they will give him confidence and supply, which are two essential things. They won't support no confidence motions against him, so that will help stabilise his government, because at the moment he doesn't have a majority. He's only got a minority government, and we're not sure whether he'll end up with enough seats to be in majority or not. So he's a consultant, and he works very hard on relationships. He makes friends easily, and he has friends right across the parliament in different political parties, people of different political persuasions. So I think that will serve him quite well in terms of negotiating stability and also in understanding a range of people's ideas and views and how to try and serve a whole country rather than just sections of it. He grew up in council housing, in public housing, as the son of a single parent who was a mother who was a disability pensioner with crippling arthritis. He didn't find his father until many, many years later, until he was an adult. And so he has an understanding of being in low-income circumstances, and he feels very deeply the position of the people who are not very well off. So I think he'll be quite focused on trying to lift people up.
So do you think this will be a major change for Australia's direction?
It certainly feels like it. It feels that way, Georgina. It's a big shift in focus, in emphasis, in sentiment. It already feels like there's a little bit more heart in politics, I have to say. Now, what the government actually does, if it can do all of its all the things on its agenda, remains to be seen. The Prime Minister, for example, wants to implement a statement that came from Indigenous Australians a number of years back called the Uluru Statement from the Heart. That was to involve setting up what they call a voice to Parliament and entrenching that in the Constitution, so Indigenous Australians have a formal voice to government. That would be a huge change. He's committed to doing that, and he says he wants to do it very soon. So I think this is a parliament that could deliver quite significant change, and the sentiment is already quite different.
And just talking about that sentiment, what is the general mood in Australia? Are people jubilant there today?
I guess it depends which team you are barracking for. I think there are those who are quite shocked, who wanted a Liberal government returned. But there were a lot of Liberal voters who voted for independence, who said that they couldn't support their old Conservative government because it had stopped listening to the people. So I think there's a sense that this is a refresh, a change, and hopefully the inclusive language of the new Prime Minister means that even those people who didn't support the new government will find something to appreciate and like, and will feel that he's governing for them. And I know that certainly that's what he said today that he wants to do.
Karen Middleton, thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll catch up with events in Sri Lanka, hear from the World Economic Forum in Davos, and
I believe in magic, and I think as soon as you touch just the corner of magic, it disappears, and then you have to carry on chasing it. And so there's a kind of a constant process in making art about that.
BZ Bailey, the South African artist, tells us about the work he's currently showing in Britain. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Let's turn now to the ongoing political and economic crisis in Sri Lanka, where the country's facing the worst fiscal situation since independence in 1948. The island nation in the Indian Ocean has now defaulted on its debts for the first time in history. Well, I'm joined now by Tanya Warnakula-Soria, a writer based in Colombo. Tanya, thanks so much for coming on the programme. Can you give us the details on this debt default?
Yes, Georgina, sure. So the 30-day payment period to repay $78 million of interest on outstanding debts of $50 billion to foreign creditors, that is set to expire on Wednesday, 2 days' time. And Sri Lanka has announced that it will not be able to pay this, thereby defaulting on those debts for the first time ever in its history. Now, as horrific as that headline sounds, this, according to the governor of Sri Lanka's central bank, is what is known as a preemptive default. So effectively a deliberate default to effectively force Sri Lanka's creditors, countries like China and India, who are the main creditors, to enter into discussions to restructure the current debt so that Sri Lanka has a more manageable payment plan. For example, it might be smaller payments over a longer period. Now, this deliberate defaulting is actually encouraged by the IMF as a solution for easing the current crisis, because the IMF's initial investigations into helping Sri Lanka have shown that the current economic crisis, with no foreign reserves and inability to pay, you know, essentials like food and fuel, the country can't sustain its current debt plan. So it does not have the money to continue making these repayments, and that's why the default needs to occur. The IMF is currently here. It's investigating, and it's in its discussion phase with Sri Lanka on a loan program that's set to conclude this Thursday, this week. But China and India have been stalling on that restructure for what appear to be their own political reasons. So at the moment, both countries are using Sri Lanka as a sort of poster child. So for China, we are being held up like a health warning on the back of a cigarette packet. And they're holding us up, and also Pakistan, to other South Asian countries and saying, if you can't manage your debts that you've incurred with our Belt and Road Initiative, then this could be you. And conversely, India is using us to improve their foreign relations and to be seen as the benevolent big brother, helping its neighbor by pumping in more and more credit and aid, which is now at $3.5 billion from India alone. Neither as yet are open to talking about that restructuring of debt, which is what Sri Lanka desperately needs. And of course, the IMF is also using Sri Lanka as a cautionary tale to other poor countries, saying that, you know, we're the first of many countries entering the world and entering into this global recession, which, unless Sri Lanka gets a workable solution up and running very quickly, will be not very good, because as more countries suffer economically, Sri Lanka's priority to get aid becomes diluted, because the demands on the IMF will increase. So the current government in Sri Lanka really does need to start focusing its energies on moving the country out of this crisis rather than concentrating on amassing political power.
And what's the inflation situation?
So the inflation is rising. It's currently at 30%, and it's set to go beyond that up to 40%. Prices will continue to rise, over the next few months, unabated.
How much of this crisis is unfortunate? COVID, soaring food and fuel prices, and how much is just down to government mismanagement?
Well, I think if you ask most people on the ground, they will say it's all down to government mismanagement. And actually, that has been corroborated by a number of economists around the world, many consultants who have come here and done work here on project. One consultant was quoted as saying the egregious corruption that has happened for many years across Sri Lanka is what has exacerbated any sort of impact that COVID and the 2019 bomb attack, all of those crises that happened, and the tsunami, all of those things that happened, never saw the level of shortages and the level of poverty and impact that has happened to the country at the moment. And it's simply because we don't have foreign reserves. We have got a dilution of our currency because there was just an extreme overprinting of rupees and mismanagement and malfeasance of money.
And are the protests against the government ongoing, and who's protesting, and how are the police dealing with it?
The protests are ongoing. So we have a core set of young protesters with the Gotagama protest village, mainly outside Temple Trees, which is the official Prime Minister's residence, but also across the country as well. But regularly sort of staggered in amongst their sort of standard protests. You will have trade union protests, you will have professional bodies protesting. We've had another student, a university protest that happened last week. We've had protests from persons with disabilities, persons who are hard of hearing. So lots of different communities kind of sustain the protest, and so that we're not really seeing too much protest fatigue, because people are coming in their communities and sort of supporting and continuing to say the president needs to go and we need to get political stability.
Now, there have been a number of solutions floated. There's a World Bank loan. The central bank governor says that the World Bank will give money. The Group of Seven meeting in Germany last week said they supported efforts to provide debt relief. And then, as you say, the International Monetary Fund will talk about a possible loan program on May the 24th. But I wonder if there's even a finance minister to negotiate with at the moment.
There is a finance minister. There is also the central bank. Mr. Nandalal Wickremesinghe is the one who is actually doing a lot of the discussions with the IMF and the World Bank. And he is sort of eminently qualified to do so. But yes, there needs to be a proper sort of negotiated and understood finance plan put in place. And this is not happening at the moment.
And finally, will Rajapaksa manage to hold on to his job? And is there any chance that he'll ever be held accountable for this awful mess?
The people would like to certainly think so. That, you know, there is pressure on the Attorney General and on the law courts for various things. And in fact, travel bans have been issued against the former Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa and certain members of his family, pending investigations into the violence that erupted on the 9th of May. There is still extreme pressure for the President to go. He does not want to go. He thinks he can stay in for the next 2 years. So that's where we are. But the people on the street, everybody will basically be saying "go to go home," which is the national cry, saying for President Gotabaya to leave.
Tanya, thank you very much indeed. That's Tanya Warner-Kulasuriya in Colombo. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Ukraine and Poland have agreed on joint customs control to ease the movement of people and increase Ukraine's export potential. Leaders of both countries touted the increased cooperation between the nations during a meeting in Kyiv yesterday. Australia's Labour Party leader, Anthony Albanese, has become the country's 31st Prime Minister, promising to bring the country together after a fractious election campaign as he vowed to tackle climate change and inequality. Although votes are still being counted, Albanese was sworn in earlier today in order to attend a key meeting of the Quad security grouping in Tokyo tomorrow. And US President Joe Biden has assured Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida that the United States is fully committed to Japan's defense. The two leaders met today to discuss Japan's plans to expand its military capabilities in response to China's growing might. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, the world's top business leaders and politicians are gathering in Davos for the World Economic Forum, which opened last night and continues until Thursday. The annual meeting was delayed from its usual January slot due to the pandemic. Monocle's Chris Chermak attended the opening last night and joins us now. Chris, good morning to you. What's the atmosphere like in Davos, and who's there?
You know, it's interesting. We went, good morning, Georgina, first of all. We went up the last night for sort of a light opening, I suppose you could say, in terms of the formal side of things. There was an interesting media reception with Ukrainian MPs. And otherwise, the atmosphere, I'd say one is just the simple thing that, you know, it's always worth repeating at this point for any of these types of conferences. People are just kind of happy to be out again, to be meeting in person. We were just sort of walking the streets of Davos because, you know, so much of this, it's not necessarily just about the formal part of it. It's also about the houses that you have that are hosted by different countries and different businesses. And we're sort of just walking through the streets. It's a very different atmosphere, in part because it's spring, of course. Davos, normally the World Economic Forum takes place in January, a very snowy scene. This time it was very nice. It was sort of about 18 degrees. It was sort of, you know, nice to walk around the city. So people were out on the streets exploring. And yeah, generally just sort of happy to meet, you know, while they have the opportunity again to join and sort of join packed rooms. And in that sense, it was interesting because it was also a mix in terms of countries. This one is not necessarily as big as some others. Certain countries, for example, China obviously is more in lockdown, so there are not many people there from China. Russia, of course, is not there. No political leaders, no business leaders either. So it is a bit more of a scaled down event, if you will, than some previous years. About a third of the amount of people are expected, around sort of 2,500 people or so this time. And in terms of major speakers, yeah, it's not the biggest leaders as it might be in some. U.S. President Joe Biden is not here either. There's a bit more of a focus, I would say, on Europe. A lot of the European leaders are here, but also Africa, Latin America. There will be a big Latin American presidential panel coming up tomorrow. So there are quite a few leaders here, and of course, a certain amount of philanthropists. Bill Gates is here, as it would be expected. So there is still quite a buzz, I would say. It's slightly more perhaps informal than previous years, but still a strong buzz of people happy to be back, happy to be connecting with each other.
And what are the main topics or the top priorities?
Well, it really is a bit of a mishmash, if you will, and I think that reflects the uncertainties of the world that we're currently in. The line, if you will, the theme is history at a turning point, and that really does encompass everything, doesn't it? I mean, obviously the war in Ukraine is at the top of this, and in terms of how that shakes out, it just sort of shakes out into so many other issues. We've had an economic crisis as a result of that. We also have an energy transition going on, partly due to, of course, climate change, which is a topic here in Davos, but also just because of, you know, having to transition away from Russia and find new energy sources. Food security is a topic that was raised quite a bit, will be already last night, and will be continue to be raised through this week, also something that is the result of Ukraine. So it's, yeah, a whole mix of topics, but the focus certainly is to a large degree on the fallout from Ukraine.
And how much is that a factor? I mean, I understand, for instance, Russia House, obviously not there, but there's a sort of Russia War Crimes House now.
Exactly right. Yes, there is a Russia War Crimes House, which is run by the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation, which is also running Ukraine's house. Viktor Pinchuk is sort of a businessman and arts person out of Ukraine, very prominent. And we visited the Russia War Crimes House yesterday as well. And yes, it is interesting because it's in this beautiful building that used to be where Russia would house its own operations. It's a beautiful sort of building in the middle of the city. And, you know, just last year, Vladimir Putin was still giving us a special address to the World Economic Forum. And this year, that house has been turned into this installation, which documents a certain amount of it, sort of has a map that shows where war crimes have taken place, how many civilians have been killed, and then just incredibly, you know, moving photographs. You know, there's a wall where it sort of changes every second, essentially, to different photographs from the war and the destruction that took place from the war. So it's a very moving scene. There were, of course, a lot of people around there as well. And Yeah, it just sort of shows how much the focus has changed, if you will, to Ukraine. As I said at the top, also there was this media reception where five Ukrainian MPs and a Ukrainian photographer spoke to all of the media ahead of the summit, and their message too essentially was keep the focus on Ukraine, keep the focus on Ukrainian media, but also in general, please don't underestimate us. One Ukrainian MP I thought spoke very strongly about this idea that, you know, even ahead of the invasion, she was saying that, you know, even Western leaders were giving us about 48 hours, and here we are 3 months later. Please do not underestimate us. We will continue this fight, and you must continue to support us. And it's just interesting that they, in that sense, are there. Some other countries, as I mentioned, might not have made the trip. Ukrainian MPs, Ukrainian civil society, they have all made the trip here, and it shows how important it is for them to get this message out, to be interacting with journalists, business leaders, and politicians, to really speak up and let the world hear their stories.
Chris, thank you very much. That was Monocle's Chris Chermak speaking to us from Zurich, and I'm quite sure we'll be hearing much more from him in the coming days as he reports from Davos. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Just gone 8:36 in Zurich, that's 7:36 here in London, and we'll continue now with today's papers. I'm joined by Alessio Patilano, who's professor at King's College London. Now, Alessio, Joe Biden not in Davos, that's because he's in Asia. Tell us more about this trip. It's a front page story in many publications.
Good morning, Georgina. This is indeed a very big news because, you know, this is the first trip that the president is making to the region since he was elected, and also the first time that an American president in the 21st century visiting Asia, not stopping in China. There's a big sort of layer of symbolism. As you know, since the war in Ukraine started, there has been a lot of questions about the fact that the attention to the Indo-Pacific would be sort of drawn away and again sort of turning towards Europe. But then the Biden administration launched the Indo-Pacific strategy right in the middle of the invasion of Ukraine. And so there was a lot of anticipation about this trip. And perhaps one of the most sort of potentially important stops is the one in Japan, not only because Japan has been one of the anchors of the United States, if you want, in the region, but also because this week a lot of things are taking place. The Biden administration is launching the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. Then Japan is hosting a big conference on the future of Asia. So there's a lot of expectation for Biden to start telling us what the economic prosperity side, we know the security element of this story, but what is Indo-Pacific means in economic terms to the Biden administration. That's the big ticket in town this week, and everybody is looking at the president as he walks through the halls of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo.
Alessio, I wonder how the change of prime minister in Australia is going to affect the Quad meeting, which of course takes place this week too.
So that's an excellent question, Georgina, because among other things, of course, the Quad meeting is also hosted in Tokyo this time around. So the Japanese are going all in. And one of the pillars that the Biden administration in the IPEF, so this Indo-Pacific Economic Framework that wants to push forwards, has to do with climate change, sustainability. And of course, with a change of administration in Australia, that opens up a whole host of new opportunities, because we know that the new Prime Minister Albanese, one of the first things he said was that Australia will be a completely different actor in international affairs when it comes to climate change. And again, this being part of the, you know, you package this in different ways, whether it is decarbonisation, whether it is resilience, whether it is tackling the challenge of climate change. These are all sort of elements that are connected to this bigger picture. So the change of guard in Australia might very well help the Biden administration and indeed reinforce the sort of triangular Japan, Australia, US tendency that we've seen over the past few months and years.
Let's go now to the Straits Times. Tell us what the lead article there is.
So again, because this is a big story, I thought it was really interesting to see a different angle. Singapore is a very good set of lenses, if you want, to take a different perspective, a non-American, if you want, perspective on the region. And here there's a very interesting report on ahead of the meeting this week in Tokyo with PM Lee of Singapore talking about development, the role of China, and how they see and they expect to sort of the comeback of the United States. Now, as you can imagine, the Singaporeans have always been very keen in trying to walk a tightrope, one in which they seek to find some sort of balance. And this is no sort of exception to that general rule. But what is interesting is very much the idea that from a Singaporean perspective, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is not a trade deal and is not about lowering tariffs, whilst perfectly understood in Singapore, it is also sort of seen as perhaps one step of a longer term engagement towards broader frameworks like CPTPP and RCEP, these two big economic framework in the region. So I think there is an expectation there from Singapore, certainly to hear from Biden. And in a way, I think they very much sort of capture the broader regional atmosphere. This isn't just about new economic initiatives to favor regulations and governance in new spaces like digital economy, like supply chains, like decarbonization, but also about the bigger sort of long-term commitment of the United States. A very interesting perspective indeed.
Let's go to the FT now with a big read on German military spending.
Yes, and I apologize because I couldn't find something that would sort of nicely avoid the shock of changing completely subject. But to be honest, I am very much in love with the FT longer reads because they are very interesting. They are slightly more in-depth and they really sort of prompt all sorts of questions. And this today, you have the longer read on reflecting upon the announcement shortly after the invasion of Ukraine started that the German Chancellor would put 100 billion euros into German defense. And I think it's a good read for at least three reasons. Number one, because it really highlights the state of decay of the German army and the fact that it has been underfunded for a number of years, which, Georgina, let's face it, from a UK perspective, it's almost refreshing because we hear all the time about the problems with the British army and underinvesting in the UK. Well, you know, look at Germany, and that's even more troubling, if you want. So there's that. The second element of this, it brings a human face to the German military, to the German...
We seem to have lost you, Alessio... Are you back?
Can you hear me still?
You were saying it brings a different
perspective to the human dimension of German military affairs. Because yes, you can pour money into this, but at the same time, it doesn't necessarily change overnight the situation. You have to change the perception of people. You need to change the perception within the military about themselves. And so the article covers that angle quite nicely. And the last point is to what extent this is a quick fix that might not actually sort of change long term, in the sense that the state of underspending has been such a long period of time that raises really an interesting question. Okay, once you spend all this money, will you have a new starting baseline and will you continue to fund it? So a very good read and something that really sort of allows us to reflect in broader terms about this very sensational, very important announcement about a month and a half ago.
And finally, huge heat wave.
Yes, hot days ahead. I mean, not that, you know, people in London haven't noticed yet, but apparently this will continue for the next few days. We have an unseasonal 10 to 15 degrees sort of going up. So next week, half turn, apparently the thing to do, if you can do it, is run away to places like France or Spain or indeed Scotland if you feel too hot, really.
That's extraordinary. Here in Britain, we love it. But of course, it's awful that it points to climate change.
You did it, this.
Yeah. Alessio, thank you very much indeed. That's Alessio Patalano here on The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It's time to talk business now with Vicky Price, economist and former joint head of the UK government's economic service. Good morning to you, Vicky.
Good morning.
Now, we know that Davos is starting or has started. Lots of warnings from the head of the IMF about high food and energy costs.
Indeed. I mean, we've heard that before, of course, but it looks like the IMF is getting increasingly worried. As we know, he has already recalculated its estimates for growth for this year and for next year, bringing this year certainly considerably down, and also worried particularly about the poorer nations, which not only are facing quite a considerable pressure because of food price increases and fuel, of course. I mean, we're all facing it, but poorer nations in particular. But also those nations had borrowed quite a lot, have debts, which perhaps looked like they were able to manage it before. But what's been going on, of course, is that the dollar and other currencies are rising, the currencies on which their debt is denominated. And the concern is that with that and with higher interest rates, that is going to make it much more difficult for them to service their debt. So the expectation is that it's going to be quite a lot of pressure for those countries. And the IMF, of course, is already gearing up to be assisting quite a lot of countries who are bound to come sort of begging and banging at the door, really. So it's not an easy sort of situation to be looking at right now. So what the IMF is doing is, on the one hand, is saying, you know, watch the debt situation. On the other hand, they realize that spending perhaps will continue to happen in places where those at the poorer end of the pay scale, if you like, and also in countries that are suffering most, get the support that they need. So the cost of living crisis is very much up there in their minds, which is affecting, as we know, everybody.
Including Wall Street, which entered a bear market territory on Friday briefly.
Absolutely. What we've seen is, since the beginning of the year, really, you know, quite a considerable reduction in the share prices in particular, investors losing confidence, you know, withdrawing their sort of support in various areas. So it's interesting when you look at what's been going on in terms of global equity mutual funds, where we saw has been a big outflow last week and a very big one over the last 4 weeks. And it's really interesting when you look at what's happened to even the stocks that were praised a lot in previous years. I mean, I was looking at some of the data for the pharmaceutical companies, for example, which had done so well in 2021. So we had Pfizer up 60%, BioNTech 215%. We mustn't forget that. I mean, we were in a period of boom in share prices last year, and pharma companies, of course, did well. Moderna itself, 145%. So what we've seen so far in 2022 is a drop. I mean, it hasn't by any means obliterated what has happened before, but we have Pfizer down 15%, BioNTech down 35%, Moderna down 40%. So the question is, you know, how long will that last? I mean, it shouldn't really for those firms, but it is a general belief that perhaps we are moving towards stagflation. And that is reflected, I think, in what the IMF was also worried about. In that environment, it's really difficult to keep countries going, let alone companies.
Now, there's new analysis on pay ratios.
Yes, that's really interesting. It's coming out today. And as it happens, I'm going to be commenting on that later on when they release their proper findings in about an hour's time or a couple of hours' time. And it is interesting, the High Pay Center has been doing this research, and what it found was, of course, you know, you wouldn't be terribly surprised about that, but during the pandemic, things, you know, got slightly better in terms of the ratios for pay, which in itself, you know, is still pretty high. I mean, as we know, there's been a bit of an outcry, and it's interesting it's happening now, given that we've got Davos and all the leaders are going to be saying all sorts of very good things about how we are responsible and shareholder capitalism has come to an end, or at least will be responsible capitalism from here on, even though shareholders still need to get the returns that they need. So what we've seen with this particular survey is that they looked at across the FTSE 350, and what has happened is that the median CEO pay, by comparison to the median employee pay, So you look at a particular company and you look at what the CEO is getting, what the employees are getting at, you know, the median one figure. And that had come down from 53.1 to 53.21 in 2019-2020, which is still pretty high, to just, if one can call it that, 44.21 in 2020-21. But what they're seeing is that this is now changing. They've looked at the companies that have reported results for the first quarter of this year. And what they're showing is that those companies, 69 of them that they have looked at, we've reported so far, that ratio has gone up to 63.21. So, and that is double for those companies, the 34.21 that they had in 2021. So that's just for the 69, not, you know, the FTSE 350. So those were reported so far. So that's a real concern, that this, what's happening is that they're getting rewarded. Of course, a lot of the improvements that have taken place perhaps have nothing to do with what they've done. And as you know, certainly the UK, but also internationally, there's a lot more focus on perhaps taxing energy companies, oil companies more. And there are arguments for wider sectors which have done well as a result of the very big increase in demand that's taken place since the easing of restrictions and high prices, of course, for the commodities or their products. Sorry. Yeah. Yes.
Finally, just a quick look at science funding and UK-EU collaboration, because that's going to be knocked now by issues over the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Yes, there is a real problem for spending on science or research and development. I mean, so far we have been members, I mean, since before we left the EU, we were benefiting from membership at the Horizon Programme, which is basically a big fund that is set up by the EU, of which we are members, where every country was contributing a certain amount to a joint sort of pool, and that was then distributed across various nations, but only on condition, or more or less on condition, that it should be collaborative research. So the amount that we were supposed to be putting in, because we agreed now, even though we were leaving the EU in the negotiations, that we would still participate in the Horizon Programme, but it was dependent on all sorts of things. Well, the problem is that we haven't so far been allowed access to it. So we haven't been able to even pay the 6 billion or so we were supposed to be paying. The government here in the UK says that perhaps we can have that money separately paid to institutions here, forget the EU. But in reality, it's the collaboration that matters. And because of the Northern Ireland Protocol, those discussions about the UK really properly entering that Horizon programme, which is about 95 billion over a number of years, have stalled. So the scientists say that until now, we were actually receiving more than we were paying for a number of years, because we have such good science base here in the UK. And now this collaboration is just not happening. Lots of things have just stopped. And this collaboration, of course, which had helped us hugely in terms of the position we've held on science across the world and certainly in Europe, is now being threatened by the Northern Ireland Protocol discussions, which is, you know, interesting way around. The indirect impacts of those political negotiations can be very significant.
Yeah, yeah. Vicky, thank you very much indeed. That was Vicky Price, and this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. And finally on today's show, the world-renowned South African artist Beezy Bailey is showcasing his brand new works in two concurrent exhibitions at the London Gallery Everard Reed and in Boughton House, one of Britain's finest stately homes in Northamptonshire. Bailey's previous work has featured collaborations with luminaries such as Brian Eno and David Bowie. His new twin show is titled Let There Be Light. Well, I went to meet him at Everard's space in London, and I began by asking him why he decided to split his exhibition into two parts.
Well, the opportunity to exhibit at Boughton House came up, and so it was a great challenge to be able to work with the collection from Boughton House at the same time as producing the work for the exhibition that we're looking at now. And so I was confronted, or given the challenge, of producing a large body of work, which I call my Beezy work, which is the work I do out of my imagination all the time, and then extend it into references from the Duke of Buccleuch's collection, including a Da Vinci Mother and Child, a Rembrandt that I didn't use, but I used El Greco Nativity painting, which is in the Barton collection. And then actual just, there's a one painting I did which was very well received called The Duke's Hounds, where, you know, he's running across the landscape following his hounds, which I kind of copied in some ways instead of silkscreen, which I did with the other ones. And then I thought then the references to South Africa and Britain and our histories and the colonial project and the kind of devastation involved, as well as you could say the construction in some ways. So I painted a trail of fire coming from behind the horses as the Duke's hounds go chasing across the landscape. I thought that was quite an interesting kind of cross history, you could say.
Why do you call this your BZ work as opposed to what other kinds of work?
Well, that's a good question. I do quite a lot of landscapes, which is very unlike the BZ work, but at the same time the BZ work references landscapes, as you can see. The landscapes are very conventional. I simply do them in open air and from observation. So I'll do that. I might do a project, a specific project, such as working with the Duke's collection, which would differ slightly from the pictures or the sculptures that you normally see, and that's why I'd refer to it as BZ work as opposed to a different type of work or a different type of project.
You've also collaborated with several musicians.
Yes, I have. Those musicians all wanted to be painters when they were young, and I wanted to be a rock star, so we met in the middle somewhere. And music's a very important part of my life. Dancing's a very important part of performance that I've done, or an integral part of my world. There doesn't have to be a distinct line between art and music, and they don't have to be put into separate boxes necessarily.
Well, this work here at the gallery in London, at the Everard Reed Gallery, absolutely sings with life, and you can hear the music, you can see the figures dancing to it, moving to it, the colour just pops out at you. I wonder how much of this is because of the wonderful surroundings in which you paint. You're mostly based in Cape Town. Is that where most of this work was created?
Yes, it was. Most of it was painted in Cape Town, quite a lot here. But then when I'm in England, I make sure I'm here in summer, and then the day like today where, again, the light is just beautiful and the colours. So generally, I cannot survive in bad weather or in grey-coloured places. I need light and I need colour and I need sun. And, of course, one is blessed with this, you know, incredible colour and light in South Africa.
Tell me a little bit more about the work that surrounds us, because, as I say, that the colour's extraordinary. What I also like is that the way you play with titles, and the titles are all so evocative.
Yeah, so what's interesting is I never work with a pre-concept. I work on several paintings at the same time, and then I look at them and then give them names after I've painted them. And themes run through the work. That, you know, the Anthropocene, with that one with the elephants, is a good example where, you know, the earth is on fire and there's elephants crossing this rather desolate landscape. I am referencing the kind of collapse of the world environment as we know it. It frightens me a lot, and I think it's important to acknowledge and to work with it in some way. So there is that happening as well. Sometimes it can be slightly professorial. It's a painting I did which in some ways predicted the Ukrainian war, which I did last year. And it does become a fascinating process. And I also trying to capture magic. I believe in magic, and I think as soon as you touch just the corner of magic, it disappears, and then you have to carry on chasing it. And so there's a kind of a constant process in making art about that.
And just before we go, I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about the artistic scene or landscape in South Africa at the moment.
What's interesting about South Africa, and always has been, is that it's an unsettled place. It's a brutalized place. It's not an easy place. There's you know, grinding poverty. There's all sorts of challenges politically. And I think in many ways that fuels the work. I couldn't manage living in a kind of Sweden or in Germany or some kind of nanny state, and everything's just so normal and perfect. And I think there's also kind of enough of a grit in England. But I mean, so in terms of material, in terms of inspiration, one needs and feeds off all of artists feed off that kind of disquiet and the challenges that it throws out. And I think, yeah, it's a very healthy environment in which to make art.
And that was South African artist BZ Bailey. His exhibition, Let There Be Light, is on until the 1st of June. And that's all for today's programme. Many thanks to everybody working behind the scenes, with particular thanks going to our studio manager, Callum McLean. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll be back on The Globalist the same time tomorrow.